Okay, so maybe we discuss the six perfections now. But first we just go over each point of the path from beginning to up to here, just showing the continuity, showing the steps. Well, actually first, we'll discuss here. Okay, the very first step that Atisha, when he wrote this text in the 11th century or something, a little text called Light, that guides you on your way. What he did was took all this vast body. He's from India, and he'd been from this great Nalanda tradition, this amazing monastic university system that flourished from the 7th to about the 11th century or something in India. And I'll do one of my commercials. Actually, there's a CD and a DVD in the shop. I don't know if you've been to the shop. They raised money for my Bodhicitta Trust. But the postcards that are there, one is the Laudo Trek. As I mentioned, I think we've got the third year now. We're going in October up to, we start in Kathmandu, we go to Lukla, and then we walk up 4 days, and then we do a 6 or 5 day retreat. Did you do that? Or was that you went to the pilgrimage? Which one? Urana? Pilgrimage. Both. Oh, well done. She's done both. So she can be an advertisement for you. You can ask her what it was like. But we did the Laudo Trek, which is about 15 days, 14 days. That's kind of really basic, you know, but it's intense. And we walk up 4 days, and then we spend 6 days up there doing retreat, 4,500 meters up. And it raises money for Rinpoche's cave up there, his cave and like a retreat center run by his sister and his brother. But the other advertisement is the other one, I said, Nalanda Monastery. Since 2001, we've been doing this pilgrimage to all the holy places of the Buddha, where Buddha put his feet in India, starting in Nepal, though, and that raises money for the prison project, certainly in the States and Australia. And that's, I mean, I've done about 16 of those, and I'm not bored yet. It's very amazing. I never get tired of it. Somehow it's extraordinary going to these places. It's something very special going to these places where the Buddha went. And the Indian government kind of takes beautiful care of them, you know. So we start in Kathmandu, and then we always start in Kompan Monastery, Lamasopa's Monastery. We've cut a couple of things out, but then we fly and go to Lumbini, where the Buddha was born. We spend a day there. We go to these places, and Rinpoche gave us all this advice about practices to do at each of these places. And many people who come, maybe not Buddhists, but somehow they just love, people love doing it. I don't know, it's very amazing. People have special experiences, special dreams. It's very fascinating to watch it, you know. So then we get our bus from India, and then we drive to India, and we go to Shravasti, which is about 10 hours away, which is usually not a place where many tourists go, because it's where the Buddha spent all his rainy season retreats with his disciples. And it's very special there. We spend a couple of days there, then we drive another 10 hours, and we go to 8 hours, 10 hours to Kushinagar, where Buddha passed away, a couple of days there. Then we just do these pujas and things at these places. We've got a prayer book, we have different prayers and practices. And people have fun as well, you know. And then we go to Rajgir, where we talk, Heart Sutra. And then near there, there's a place called Nalanda Monastery, this vast ruins. It's huge already, but they said probably only a small amount has been unearthed. It flourished between the 7th and 11th century, you know. And then its demise, and really, indeed the demise of Buddhism in India, fairly much coincided with the growth of Islam in India. It's just the way it is, you know, not criticizing, it's just karma. And this amazing monastery, Nalanda Monastery, all the great Vajrayana and Mahayana yogis and scholars, and His Holiness always refers to the Nalanda tradition. All the texts and the great meditators and scholars, including Atisha, from there were the ones that the Tibetans use as their basis, you know, for their studies. It's like a replica, really, of the Nalanda monastery tradition. So Atisha was invited to Tibet back in the 11th century or something. Buddhism had been flourishing there for a couple of centuries. And he came along, he was this great scholar and yogi, and he saw that Buddhism was flourishing, but there was not much coherence in the understanding of what was going on. There was lots of Vajrayana, lots of this and lots of that. So he wrote this little text, and really what he did was take the essential points from all the body of knowledge, what's studied in the, you know, the basic program here, the master's program, what's certainly studied in more depth 20, 30 years in the monasteries, all the literature, going back to the Indians, and all the Tibetan commentaries on this vast body of knowledge, which is the basis of all the Buddhist knowledge, right? So the Lamrim, Atisha, put together this really short little text, simple, grounded. He took the essence of all these points and he presented them, as I've been saying, in a very orderly way. Orderly, according, like any body of knowledge, according to the level of disciple. And of course, with any knowledge, if you want to, especially with, say, it's like, say, music, no, anything, anybody knows, you want to experience the truth of it. And that's the crucial thing here. It's all Buddhist philosophy. And we often don't think philosophy is to be internalized. That's really actually a major point. I think it's our view is sort of the Socratic approach. You don't practice philosophy. You have a very wide open mind and you open yourself to all these ideas. But there's no idea. And the second part is they're all open-ended. There's never a result. I mean, I find that pretty nihilistic, quite frankly. And you don't practice it. That's even weirder. I think that's our view in the West with philosophy. So the Buddha's view is the exact opposite. Philosophy for the Buddha is meant to be, from his own direct experience, a finding about the truth. We often think of philosophy as speculation. We're allowed to have these ideas. You don't get too stuck in them. Nothing wrong with being open-minded. But for the Buddhist approach, it's manageable, it's doable, it's workable because it's direct experience. It's Buddha's view of reality. It's an interesting view, an interesting approach. Remember Professor Jeffrey Hopkins, one of the major Buddhist professors, you know, when I first worked with him in the 80s when I was living in England and working for Wisdom Publications, and we published one of his first major books, Meditation on Emptiness, which had been like this thesis and is just usually available then like in microfiche, the old-fashioned way they used to do things. So we published it. I remember working with him and he taught 83 or something, 82. And he told me, he said he began the Buddhist studies program in Virginia in 76. And I think it was the first kind of major Tibetan Buddhist body of studies in American universities run by a practitioner, an actual Buddhist. And he said he was looked down upon by his fellow philosophers because it's seen as inferior to practice it. This is a really interesting point in our culture. You're supposed to be sort of objective because we don't trust subjective in our culture. It's very interesting. Anyway, Atisha, what he did was take all these points from this vast body of philosophy and he presented he had an agenda to help us get experience. So the first point he mentioned, he kind of cobbled together this little contemplation, which we know, of course, is called meditating on your perfect human rebirth. So it's really just doing like some market research. And you know how you go on the computer and you look up things and only 1% of people have computers and 7% of people have this and 2% of people have that. And then we start to realize, wow, we're one of those people. Aren't we fortunate? Well, this meditation on your perfect human rebirth is a bit like that. And Atisha has about 18 different bullet points. But basically it's contemplating all of the advantages we have and all the disadvantages we've avoided having. The conclusion is we have this precious, amazing life, like we've won the lottery, you know. We're like the 0.01% of the universe, but not in terms of riches, but in terms of good fortune. And, of course, we know it's come from karma, so we don't take it for granted. So his first thing is to get us energized in realizing how fortunate we are, you know, not just thank somebody, not just thank God or the universe, no. And then, of course, his conclusion, the action point every time is, in this case, the action point is don't waste it. Now, then he gets us to enter into junior school, entry level grade one of the first scope of junior school, of the actual practice. And he takes all of Buddha's extensive teachings about impermanence, as we've discussed, but he frames it in terms of gross impermanence, death. Very specifically, his agenda is to increase our wake-up call. It's all about impermanence, which is Buddha's vast teachings. But he gets us to think about death, because that's the most powerful one for us, because his agenda is to give us a wake-up call, to increase our wake-up call. Having thought about the perfect human rebirth. Then the next step he gets to in this packaging, the way he presents, is to think about the suffering of the lower realms. I mean, this is a bizarre and weird idea for us coming out of nowhere, you know. I know that the Lama Zopa, when he started teaching Westerners in like 1971 or something, 70, I think, yeah, this year is the 50th anniversary. It's going to be a big party at Koppan of these courses for Westerners, for foreigners. So Lama Zopa taught his first one in 1970. And I remember one, like the fourth or fifth course, apparently is uproar because Rinpoche started teaching all these texts and all this literature about the lower realms. I mean, it's vast, it's in depth in the literature. You know, we've got to remember this is in the Buddhist philosophical view of the universe, not just some analogy. And so why at this point would we be thinking about the suffering of the lower realms? Again, a teacher's agenda is given that death is definite, given that the time of death is uncertain, and given that every single thing you think and do and say will sow seeds, and at the time of death, the only thing you can bring with you is your virtue, then he gets us to increase our wake-up call by thinking about the likely possibilities of rebirths. So in a sense, he's trying to scare the life out of us. Just like your doctor would when she plays you those videos of people with hideous cancer in their lungs. You get the shock of your life. So we thank the doctor for that. But hearing about the lower realms, it's like complete uproar among Western hippies. You know, people would leave in droves. It's like this insane kind of worse than the Baptist fundamentalists about hell. Detailed descriptions from all the yogis about hell experiences. The hot hells, and it's plural. Hot hells, cold hells. It's shocking to hear. Last year, one of my friends, John Jackson, he was, Rinpoche every year appoints someone to teach the Kopan course in November. There are courses all the way through the year, but traditionally there's this major course in November, which has been going on since 1970. So last year, I think, Rinpoche asked this monk, who's the same age as me, we're both born in the year of the monkey, he's not a troublemaker, maybe he is. Tricia was born in the year of the monkey as well, 1944. So monkeys are trying to troublemakers. Anyway, I'm a troublemaker. Maybe that's because I'm a Sagittarius as well. I don't know. Anyway, the point is, he's in meditation retreat much of the time now. He wasn't a monk when he met the lamas. Now he's a monk. So he was asked by Lama Zopa to teach the course. Well, he's never taught in his life, not a word. But he's meditating on the Lam Rim. So the people said he presented the Lam Rim completely traditionally, just like Lama Zopa would. So he starts in the beginning talking about all these things, and he gets to the point where he goes into details about each of the hells. I mean, apparently 60, 70 people left the course. They thought, what's this mad person talking about? It's weird for us, you know. But the agenda of a teacher is to give us a wake-up call, because naturally you don't want cancerous lungs, and because we don't think that as punishment, we're happy that she tells us. But to hear that the Buddha says that you go to the lower realms and suffer terribly in the hells is just beyond hilarious for us. We hear it as punishment. Like I said, these are realms of existence. Minds in their states caused by those sentient beings. This is hard to hear because we don't have a view like that. It's very fascinating. And they're all, like I said, the lower realms are these expressions of these three toxic emotions. So, what's my point here? What's my point with something here? I'm getting lost again. Maybe I'm getting Alzheimer's. What do you think? I forget things. What was I started with? Lower realms. I know I mentioned that in passing. But why? Atisha. Okay, no. Okay. This Atisha. And why did I mention Atisha? Why did I mention Atisha? Because he taught this course because he lost the plot. Nalanda Monastery. Oh, that was Atisha. That's why I mentioned Nalanda. It was the other way around. Atisha. Scholar. The Lam Rim. Just maybe just mentioning the Lam Rim, that's all. No, that's true. But I forget what caused that. Never mind, that'll do. We'll come back. Don't worry. So anyway, he taught in order, you know, all these things in order. So it's junior school. I mentioned, there's some reason I wanted to go into junior school, then to go to high school. No, I was going to go, I'm just going over the points. Remember, I just said I'd summarize. That's all. I'm just summarizing all the points. We didn't mention the lower realms before, did we? We didn't say that. I skipped over that bit. Yeah, because I wanted to go back to another point now. So anyway, he went through these points, and then from the lower realms, you get this energy, you increase your wish not to waste this precious human life, because who wants that kind of suffering? No, thank you. Well, then you think, well, whom can I turn to? So here you turn to your doctor. Please give me methods to stop getting cancer. So here we could take refuge, rely upon the Buddha, blah, blah, blah. And then the culmination of junior school is when we start to put our money where our mouth is. We start to practice abiding by the laws of karma. So that's junior school. So I want to go back, though, because in the 14th century, Tsongkhapa came along, our lineage lama, and he put another little meditation in front of all that he said it was useful for us to think about as a preparation for practice, and that is the benefit of a teacher, speaking very simply. So why don't we talk about that? I mean, in the text it's taught, you know, like I said, when I was first working for Wisdom, when I first became a nun, and then started working for editing books, and I edited Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand initially, I just didn't understand this arcane, strange, complex ideas. When I first heard Lama Zopa, I just didn't know what he was talking about. So it takes a while to get the experiential implications of it all, you know, in the essential kind of way. So anyway, the thing that this teacher business, let's look at that. And I want to talk about it in a very simple way, in a very logical way, not in a kind of like the way it's taught in the text is very complex in a way, you know. So why would you want a teacher? It's a very simple, if anything, think about it. It's totally evident, you know. I think since we're born, there is nothing we have learned that we haven't learned from somebody. Well, what's that mean? That's called a teacher, isn't it? Someone shows you how to do something. It's really clear. And, of course, the person who shows you, it's helpful if they know what they're doing, if they're an expert, you know. So your mum probably isn't an expert. We don't get to learn to be mums, do we? Just even wacky people can be mums. But, you know, you have to learn. So everything we've done, we've learned from somebody who knew how to do it. That's the way the world works. Well, that's called a teacher. It's fairly evident it's the easiest way to do it. And, of course, in our ordinary world, starting at school, then university, and we can see the function of a good teacher. And first of all, the Buddhist approach is, and especially the Tibetan Buddhist, and especially the Vajrayana model, would say we really can't get far without a teacher. So then one of the commonest questions we tend to ask in the West, well, do I need a teacher, a spiritual teacher, you know? And it's very curious that we should ask it, because I think, like I just said, I don't think we can think of anything we learned that we didn't learn from a teacher, especially a very intense body of knowledge. There's no way you're going to sit there and become like Einstein by reading a book, unless you're very bright. There's no way you're going to learn to play Bach by just listening to records and reading music on the piece of paper. I don't think so. And this is where it's an evident benefit. We need a knowledge holder. The lovely word in Tibetan, rigsin. Rigsin, knowledge holder. No, knowledge holder. It's very clear, isn't it? And we all know from school, from college, maybe university, many people remember certain teachers and never forget them. The benefit, the power of that person in our lives. And that's where it's on a more human level, a heart level. So you can say all the theoretical things, and we will, about how you do find a good teacher. And clearly, a person who's a good teacher has to have the knowledge. So we understand that when it comes to even, not yoga maybe, but maybe certainly science, math, music, we know we've got to find a good teacher. We look and look and search and search. We don't just choose any old person. But often when it comes to spiritual things, because we're wishy-washy about spiritual, we don't really check, you know. We don't do much kind of market research, due diligence. We must, especially in spiritual, because we just think it's anything goes, anything's possible, you can have anybody you like. It's really shocking. It's not true. And especially because we follow our emotions. And so someone, let's say, maybe is very charismatic. Oh, wow, they must be special. They're so amazing, amazing. Wow, wow. You know, it's just a load of rubbish. They're misleading you. I mean, one example so obvious, you know. I remember in America, in California, this fellow ran a Zen center out of Los Angeles, and he invited me to come there. And he said he'd been watching me on video and wanted me to teach at his center. So I taught, and it was a very lovely group of people. And I got to know him. And then over a couple of years, you know, emails and things, and he even came on a pilgrimage with us. And I started to see this. He was very strange. He was very weird. He was his teacher. And suddenly out of the way, he started wearing robes. I thought, would you became a monk, did you? And he sort of said, yes. But he didn't tell me exactly where. So I accepted it. But slowly, from some students of his started writing and saying they're really seriously worried because he's just this serious, chronic, demented liar. And I started to see from emails. He'd just make up bizarre things, you know. He was extraordinary. He would tell one person he had a husband. He told another person he had a wife. He said one person he had children. He said his parents had died. He was chronically lying, continuously mad lying. And I started to then listen on his videos, and he knew nothing about Dharma. He had a few words. He had a good heart, you could see. And the thing was, he was quite charismatic. So people liked him. Many people really studied the Dharma with him. They got the right books. But he was a chronic liar, completely delusional person. So I felt I had no choice but to sort of point it out and copy all his board of directors because he wasn't a charity, but he was saying he was. It was just everything he did was a lie. But you couldn't tell initially because people liked him. People liked him. So even after I'd exposed him to him, I had to do it for his own benefit. I mean, some of the things he would say was, I mean, I'm nobody, okay, but I, you know, but he'd tell people that he had special, I mean, I'm nobody. Lama Zopa told me to do this job, so I do my best. But he talked to people that I was his special disciple. I got him to teach in India to 500 people. I mean, you can't imagine the rubbish he said. It was all made up, all just total delusional nonsense. But he had the gift of the speech. People believed him. This is from telling the truth in past lives. Even though he had the tendency to lie, but because he was a nice fellow, people, and even after I wrote to him and copied his board and copied all the people and said he's got serious mental problems, he must do something about it, and I thought, you know, I had to do this. He just completely went against, called me insane person, carried on doing his centre, and some people still liked him, and even though they'd seen it was wrong, and he's a liar, they continued to support him because they liked him. Got to check up who's valid and who's not, you know. So obvious somehow. So that's crucial, obviously. The thing is, though, let me think, well, what is the advantage in general, you can see the advantage of a teacher, and I think it's at a very human level. Lama Yeshe would say we all are dying for love. You're so right, you know. So if you're going to get someone to be your teacher, and the way I like to put it, and it sounds a bit strange, but listen to me, you choose your teacher. They don't drag you by the nose and pull you over here and there. You choose. You check up and you choose. And you've got to have confidence that this person's valid. You've got to have confidence that you're going to trust their advice. Any teacher is the same. I always remember, it was a very powerful learning for me in all my radical lefty days. I remember strong process that you go through, I really realized I had to do the work myself. I had to be independent, you know. I had to do it. So the thought of having any kind of teacher, I didn't want. I wanted to learn myself. So it was really strong a concept to be independent, to be autonomous, you know. I had to decide. I had to do it. I'm just going to follow what people say, which is a necessary part. We have it's a good step to go through. I remember when I was a feminist, I was very involved in feminist politics, and I was living in New York for a year, and I'd been doing martial arts. So I wanted to do martial arts in a woman's dojo in 1974. I was 76. I was 32. So anyway, I wanted a women's dojo, so I found one. It was great. Downtown, near Wall Street. All these lesbians. I was a lesbian. I chucked out the boys, had the girls. And I remember it was... you know the word dyke? It's a colloquial for a lesbian. Well, across the road there was Dyke's Lumber. We always used to joke about Dyke's Lumber across the road, you know. Anyway, I loved it. It was a marvellous place. I had wonderful friends. We'd hang out together. We'd go... Because this is the time of all the gay bars in New York, like rampant. I mean, the gay movement in New York was so strong, I remember. On the corner of my street on 7th Avenue and somewhere or other, there was this fairy queen. I mean, you know, people see people on the streets now, painted in silver, kind of people, you know, people, what do they call? This dude back then, he was a fairy queen with his wand. He'd just stand there all day, you know. Street art. Every second shop was a bar with all these gay men in it. I remember, it was a wonderful time. But I remember I did karate here for a year. Then I got to about the fourth belt or something. Then I had to go back to Melbourne. And by this point in my politics, I'd made a very firm decision that I couldn't keep hating half the human race. It wasn't going to work. Something had to shift. So I remember consciously I wanted to find a karate dojo that was taught the same style. So I found one in Melbourne, but it was a male teacher. And this was a serious decision for me. So I decided it would be good for me to do it. So I checked up. He was a good teacher, so I went. So I told him I'm in the fourth belt, whatever colour it was, I forget. And I did one class with him, and at the end of the class, he said, I'm sorry, Rabina, you have to go back to the beginning. You've got to go back to the white belts. He was very apologetic. I was outraged. I was so shocked and offended, you know. But then I thought about it, and that was the first time I had the kind of actual recognition that you need a proper teacher, just for karate. So I realized that for 1 year, I'd learned wrongly. I chose her for the wrong reason. I had a lovely time. They were my friends. She was a nice woman, but she wasn't good at karate. And I didn't know because I hadn't checked. I hadn't checked. That was a powerful learning from my mind. was when I first struck me, you need a teacher. Then it was another year later, anyway, I went down and I met the Lamas. So the thing was, when I met the Lamas, did this course with Rinpoche, 1 month intensive Lam Rim course, just like the Kopan courses. And it was, as I told you, it was a lot of culture. I did tell you, no, it was a culture shock for me, such a culture shock. It was all these hippies. I mean, I'd done the hippie thing 10 years before. It was a shock to my mind. I mean, such a shock, although I knew this is what I'd found, what I wanted. And I liked Lama Yeshe. I couldn't help but like Lama Yeshe. I just could not help but like him. But even when we did, then 1 month Lam Rim with Lama Zopa, and Lama Yeshe would come along, and he'd make me feel relieved, it was all okay, I could understand him. And then we did a 1 month of Chenrezig retreat. So all the visualizations of Chenrezig, right? He's a male Buddha. So I didn't want to visualize a male Buddha. I visualized Chenrezig as a girl, as female, you know, because I was still this radical feminist. It was a real struggle for my mind. But I was, anyway, working through it all. But the point is, I couldn't help but like Lama Yeshe. And the thought, I heard the word, I used to hear the word guru. Sorry, excuse me. Eat the toad, isn't it? Lama Zopa would let the fleas live in his socks, you know. It's not a flea, it's all right. Anyway, I liked Lama Yeshe. I couldn't help but like him. But I'd hear the word guru and I'd hear the word lama. I'd think, oh, that's disgusting. I don't want a guru. Ugh, you know. Because I remember when I was a really serious radical lesbian separatist feminist living in a group of women in Melbourne, we were serious. I mean, the vanguard of the radical lesbian separatist feminists, you know. We were very shocking in Melbourne. Women walking around kissing and holding hands on the street, practically getting arrested, you know. 1972 or something. I forget. Four. Whatever the reason. Doesn't matter. So anyway, the point is, now I forget the point, I'm forgetting everything, gossiping away. Lesbian, separatist, feminist, what was I saying? Oh yeah, and I couldn't help but like Lama Yeshe. It was a struggle for me, but I couldn't help but like him. So anyway, I went back to Melbourne after the 2 months of course. I'd taken refuge, I knew it was my path, and I'd just practice every day. And then at some point, the penny dropped. I realised Lama was my guru, and I said to my sister Polly, don't tell anybody, I've got a guru, you know. I was kind of whispered it. So it was something, you know, because I didn't know, but I'd done all the work they said you should, like you would if a decent teacher. I checked on his reputation. I checked on his disciples. I was always very impressed by seeing the students when I was at Chenrezig Institute. I mean, the couple of nuns, you know, Yeshe Kadro, she was the director. She was young, but she was a really good example. So a very powerful way to check a teacher is to look at the disciples, isn't it? The proof of the pudding there. Very powerful. I checked Lama Yeshe's teachings. I checked his disciple. Lama Zopa was his main disciple. And you could not but help be impressed by Lama Zopa. That was a really good indicator that Lama Yeshe must be a decent teacher. You understand? So I did the work. I didn't think about it like that, but that's what they say. And then over the period, it just kind of, I became connected to it, and I just decided Lama Yeshe's my teacher. So then I went back the next year, a year later, and did another course, and I wanted to have a meeting with him because I was just, I informed him he was my teacher. I didn't know you're supposed to ask. You know, you're supposed to ask and be very respectful. I just informed him. He said, yeah, I know, dear. But the point is, what I'm getting at here is an interesting point. It's the moment I made this connection with Lama, I'd done the checking, and it's like I requested. And it's like he accepted. But the thing is, that what have I just done? The way I like to put it is this. When you choose a teacher of anything, you give them permission to show you. You give them permission to kind of move in and show you. So I know another time I'd learned when I was in London as a nun, I was doing Kung Fu. So this time I did check carefully on the teacher. And this Kung Fu teacher, Mr. Lee, a Chinese Buddhist. And I was a nun at the time. I was in London. I was like 42 or something, working for Wisdom Publications, 44, I forget now. And I decided I wanted martial arts again. So I saw Mr. Lee, and I was really impressed. And he was a Buddhist. I was really impressed by this Kung Fu teacher, you know. I'd done my market research. So I checked, and then because I was, and this is the point, imagine if I'd met Mr. Lee the week before at a party and he could see that I had Kung Fu potential. He wouldn't have demanded I walk into his club and start forcing Kung Fu down my throat, would he? You see my point? I had to be wanting his Kung Fu. It was exactly the same when I met Lama Yeshe. I wanted what Lama Yeshe had. I wanted it. Now, I recognized Lama Zopa 10 years later as my guru. I knew I had a dream, a vivid dream. First of all, with Lama Yeshe, I checked on him. I couldn't help but like him. you know. And then I decided the 6 months that he was my teacher. Then I went back to Chen Raising, and I didn't know, like I said, I didn't know you're supposed to ask. So I told him, you are my, I didn't even say the word guru. I was too proud. I think I told him I respected him or something, but he knew what I meant. He said, yes, I know, dear. But then basically what I did was I gave him permission to show me, and not kung fu, not anything else, but my mind. And I wanted that. He could see I wanted it. So the very first meeting, he started showing me my mind. And what that means is he triggered some anger in me, some pride. I'd done this job. I'd done this typing job, this book. We had a printing company, and I did a new version of The Wish-Fulfilling Golden Sun. I typed it, designed it, fixed it, edited it, packed it, drove it up in an aeroplane and presented this box to Mama Yeshe, so proud of my hard work, you know. And there was a nun in the centre down there, and she didn't do anything to do with it. But Lama said to me, oh, thank you. Thank you for helping my nun. I said to myself, excuse me, she helped me. Do you understand? That was already Lama showing me my mind. The first meeting. Because why? I gave him permission. Do you hear my point? So you choose your guru, please, and you better choose carefully. As Pabongka Rinpoche says, you know, you choose your guru very carefully because you're going to end up like him. I find that it's my favourite quote from Pabongka. Do you understand? So that was my first meeting with Lama Yeshe. And then the hard work started. Then, because I'd given Lama permission to stick his nose into my mind and show me my rubbish. So how was fantasies of having a guru sit at their feet? That's a load of nonsense. I never sat at Lama Yeshe's feet once. He would whack me around, you know. He showed me my mind. That's his job. Mr. Lee showed me my kung fu. Even with Mr. Lee, I went 6 days a week because I'm a fanatic. And Mr. Lee is not stupid. He could tell I wanted his kung fu. I went 6 days a week. It was me and a 14-year-old boy and a 19-year-old boy. We were the three fanatics. We'd go to Chinatown after our kung fu class and go to McDonald's and eat 4 pounds of chips because you want your carbs. And then we'd go to all the Chinese kung fu movies. And I was 42 and these boys were like teenagers. They didn't know I was a Buddhist nun and they didn't know I was 42. I didn't confess. We're just the three fanatic students of Mr. Lee, you know. It was hilarious. But Mr. Lee could see I wanted his kung fu, so he pushed me to the limit. He would scream at me. And I was proud that he screamed at me. I wasn't depressed. I was honoured Mr. Lee screamed at me. So you've got to choose your teacher. And then because you give permission, and he could see I wanted it, and Lama Yeshe could see I wanted to work on my mind. Okay, I had trouble doing it, controlling my behaviour. I had trouble meditating. Forget about meditating. But he could tell I wanted it. I wanted what he had to give. So he started giving it to me, and it was difficult. Right there, it shocked me when he said that. Then I did my Vajrasattva retreat. You do a 3 month. I went to Koppan, and Lama Zopa gave me vows. You know, Lama Zopa ordained me, and I assumed Lama Yeshe would. I like Lama Zopa, but he was sort of behind Lama Yeshe. He wasn't my teacher at the time. And Lama Yeshe, when I asked him to make me a nun, he sent me off to Lama Zopa, and I felt a bit insulted. Not really insulted, but a little bit. And I saw Lama Yeshe in the kitchen after. And I said, did you give me my name, Lama Yeshe? And he said, no, Lama Zopa's qualified. But anyway, I got this name. Well, he gave me a name. And then I remember, because as soon as I walked into Koppan, I walked straight into the publishing room. Because I'm on the propaganda side all my life, you know, publishing, editing, graphic design. That's just what I always did. And when I finally met the Dharma, that was what I wanted most. To study, what a bore. To meditate, don't be ridiculous. But I wanted to work. I liked action, you know. So I wanted to become a nun. I'd already given up sex, drugs, cigarettes. There was nothing left. What for? You know, I've become a nun. In other words, from the time I was 13, on my knees in the kitchen, begging my mother to let me be a Catholic nun like St. Therese of Lisieux, and I cried when she said no. And then 20 years later, she cried when I said I'd be a Buddhist nun. So I remember that's what I wanted to be, as a Buddhist nun, you know, get on with it, and then get on with work. Well, I did. And I was so blissed out. And Nick asked me, would I like to work for Wisdom? I thought, what's he asking me for? It's my job, you know. See, I'm happy to help people, but I've got to lead the way. I've got to be the boss. And this is a really big shocking. This is a major shock with Lama Yeshe for me. So I did my Vajrasattva retreat, and I got a note from Nick Rebord. And we were all moving to England, to Lama Yeshe Centre there. And I'd done all this research on Wisdom. I'd organised a publishing thing. I got all the books. I was just in bliss with his work. I was so happy. And I just assumed Lama would make me the director because I was good at it. I mean, I just assumed. It wasn't arrogance. I just assumed it. Well, it was probably arrogance. It just seemed logical. And after my retreat, I got a note from Nick, and it said, fantastic, Lama says that Rabina can be the secretary. Well, I nearly fainted. And I never forget, as long as I live, I said to myself, poor Lama, he doesn't understand. That's what I said to myself. Do you understand my point? Now, the point for me is this is the value of a teacher. In my life, if I didn't get what I wanted, I was gone like the wind. Nothing would hold me. In a relationship, in a job, I didn't want to get stuck and become a victim. I'd get the hell out of there, you know? So normally, even by the Lama saying thank you to this other nun, I would have thought, what's all this about? And gone. But somehow I'd trusted him, you know? He had me by the scruff of my neck. So this one was the most shocking example, the most shocking teaching. I just couldn't believe that Lama meant this. So I went to England, and of course I had nothing to do with being a secretary. I became the boss. This poor boss, Laman Chertok, Naman Chertok, this poor monk who knew nothing about publishing. I mean, the poor thing, he would sit in his meditation box, you know. He was meant to be the director. I took no notice. I did everything. He couldn't even get in the office. Can you imagine being my boss? I mean, I tried to be humble. It was very difficult, you know, because I knew everything. And I did the accounts, I did the distribution, I did the graphic design, I did the things, I worked with a printer, I chose the paper, I did the editing, I did everything, like this martyr, you know. I was good at it, but I was this bloody secretary, supposedly, which I wasn't. And the poor church, I couldn't hardly get in the office, you know. Are we communicating here? Struggled every day, and I couldn't. And even worse, when I finished my... in that letter, when Nick said, fantastic, Rabina can be the secretary, Nick had the name of this person who was the director. And it was a Tibetan name. He was an American. And he was 12,000 miles away. Well, I can't describe the rage. I had more rage at that moment than all my life up until those 32 years. I wanted to rip every piece of his body out and chuck it to the dogs. I could not believe this person, whoever he was, I couldn't stand the sound of him. So I went to the centre, and I just kind of barged in and took over, you know. This poor fellow, God. He tried to like me, but I couldn't stand him. I'd throw teapots at him. I don't tell you other things I did. I'll confess. I mean, how kind Lama was putting up with me. And the centre director was my friend. I mean, I'd be thrown out of a centre by now, well and truly. I was there for 10 years. But after 2 years, every day crying, I'd lock my door at the end of the day, crying, and I'd do my 35 Buddhist prostrations, begging Lama to make this pain go away, you know, because I knew Lama knew what he was doing. That's why you need a teacher. Everything in my being didn't want to do it. I couldn't stand it. I was going crazy, screaming, fighting with what? Seeing my pride and my anger. It's very simple, not complicated, but I stuck with it. And after 2 years, I woke up one morning and I didn't hate him anymore. I was so blissed out, I can't tell you. So even though I was a maniac throwing teapots at him, raging, I was actually practicing. I really was, and Lama could see that. I'm so grateful, you know. So then Lama was there at the time and he wanted to come and use the phone, so I took him to my office and he cracked a joke about Chodak. And I said, oh, Lama, I don't hate him anymore. The Lama took my face and gave me a big kiss. He was blissed out, you know. So that was practice. That's practice. That's why I like my friends in prison, these maniacs, you know, because they're practicing. That's why they like me, because I can tell I'm a maniac. Do you understand, people? Okay, I don't recommend you follow my behavior. And even years later, even when I'm still struggling, and it was another director by this time, because I lost most of my jobs. I got fired from most of my jobs. I'm not joking. But I kept persevering, you know. So one other director of wisdom. I forget the story now. This story is a bit embarrassing, but I'll tell you. I never told anybody for years this story. It was Nick this time. Nick was my boss again. Nick was my boss. And he was the boss, right? But I did all my thing. But I was always tortured because I wasn't the boss. And also Nick, it's not personal, it doesn't matter. You don't know who Nick is anyway, it doesn't matter. But he couldn't handle. I was too big. My presence was too big for him and too dominating, I suppose. And he told me one time, I can't do my job with you. You have to go. Well, I said, go, you know, fuck off. I'm not going anywhere. Excuse me. But I was devastated. I was in such tears. I was so brokenhearted because I worked 60 hours a week. You know, I was worked so hard. I was so dedicated. Trying to work on my mind, trying to struggle with my behavior, you know, trying to accept that Nick was a director and I wasn't. He never gave me a title. I had to make up my own title, editorial director. Do you understand? And then I got to India, I got to Delhi, go some teachings to His Holiness, and I had a quick meeting with Lama Zopa beforehand. And I was feeling all this self-pity and kind of drama inside, and guilt and misery and unhappy and hurt, blah, blah, blah. And I asked Rinpoche for a I wrote a little note after our quick meeting for a purification practice, please. I never told him about Nick. So I got a note a lot later from his attendant. It was before Roger. And the note said this. Not even my name. It said, you tell her, if she wants to purify, visualize Nick above her head, pissing and shitting, and experience great bliss. It was my personal, special, secret practice, okay? It took me 10 years to recognize Lama Zopa. You know, 10 years. I mean, by that point, he was my teacher. But it took me 10 years to recognize him. He was always behind Lama Yeshe. And this is the interesting point. In a sense, I hadn't given him permission to show me my mind. So he left me alone. He'd crack jokes. Hello, how are you? But I knew, after my Vajrasattva retreat, I had this vivid dream. I was at Nalanda Ruins. I was doing my advertisement. That's where I was. I was doing an advertisement about Nalanda Monastery. Remember, I did the advertisement for the pilgrimage. Now we're back to Nalanda again. So I was in this dream, a vivid dream. I was at Nalanda Monastery Ruins. I didn't know until I went there years later. And all the students were there, and Lama Zopa was out, and he called me out, and he put his text over one shoulder and his robe over the other, and he told me to follow him out. So I told some Lama in Dharamsala, this was my dream. He said, oh, that's the Lama who'll lead you to enlightenment. I was very surprised, you know. I mean, now Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa for me are equal, they're the same, just different names, you know. But then I was very shocked. So I knew then, in 97, it took me 10 years to recognize, though, 10 years to work and practice. 10 years, really work hard. I had to work hard and practice and purify and make offerings in my mind. Then after I finished wisdom, 10 years, I got sacked again, another time, from Nick. Yeah, Nick sacked me twice because I didn't go the first time, you see. Don't follow my example. I'm very wicked. Lama one time when I was full of distress and self-pity, and I was moaning to Lama about my miserable behaviour, or miserable me, and he just said to me, he said, nothing wrong with your heart, dear. It's just your behaviour. And it was a revelation for me. Because you know how you feel, I am bad, you know. I am terrible. But somehow Lama, by pointing out the difference between my mind, my heart, and my meant well, but my crummy behaviour, it was a revelation. I can't tell you. It was amazing. A revelation that was very powerful for my mind. So anyway, when I finally finished wisdom, after 10 years, I was in Australia, and I had no idea what to do. And I did a Palgan Lama retreat with Rinpoche, and Lama Ursa was there. He was two at the time. The nuns would hang out with him, and we did like a 5-week, 6-week retreat. Lama Ursa was Lama Yeshe's reincarnation. And I remember I did this retreat with Lama Zopa, and then somehow when I was sitting in the centre and I didn't know what to do with my life, he called me up. And that's when the penny dropped and it became clear. And he took that, and that moment is when all the conditions came together, and it's when he told me what to do. It was the first time he gave me an instruction. And I always remember it like that Michelangelo picture, you know, God with his hand, God, you know, God, that big picture of Michelangelo's. I had this vision of that. It was like Lama Zopa pointing and saying, and he said, go to Sydney and teach. I remember it like that, coming from God, you know. That's when I started so-called teaching, in 1987. So that's when he became my teacher. Then he started showing me my mind. And that's not comfortable. Lama Yeshe never upset me, actually, but Lama Zopa freaks me out, I can't tell you. Lama Yeshe always made me happy. Whatever happened, he made me happy. I mean, he made me nervous. But Lama Zopa would freak me out. He would teach me in a different way. Lama Yeshe would just shout at me, you know. I didn't mind. But Lama Zopa would ignore me or just like, you know, go one time to have a meeting. Annette was there and she went into the office and I wanted a quick word with Rinpoche. And she said, Rinpoche, Rabina's outside. And he ignored 4 times. She came out and said, I'm sorry. So this is where you've got to check on your guru carefully. If Mr. Lee shouted at me, if I didn't think he was a good kung fu teacher, I would have sued him. But I didn't mind he shouted. Well, I didn't mind when Lama Yeshe shouted at me. I didn't mind when Lama Zopa ignored me because he showed me my mind. That's the job of the guru. Not to sit there holy, give you some Tibetan to do, you know. But to show you your mind, which means to look at your delusions because that's the cause of your pain. That's the job of the guru. And that's hard work. But you've got to trust them. If they're going to show you your mind, you better trust them. So you choose your guru very carefully, okay? You've got to be prepared for the hard work. Don't just wait for the kisses and the strokes, you know? And they came too. Occasionally I'd have them. So this is what a teacher in this summary we're discussing, that's his first point. You need a guru. And the thing is, for me, the most simple level of it is we've got human hearts. As Lama Yeshe would say, we're all dying for love, you know. And that's the part for me. We've got human hearts. This is not just an intellectual thing. You've got to love your guru. You've got to love this person. You know, I'm just even now watching on Netflix something. I watch Netflix occasionally. And there's this program about these some school kids. And one teacher, they're doing like cheerleading, something ridiculous, you know. And they absolutely adore, worship the ground this woman works on. She's tough. She pushes them to the limit, but they adore her. That's like the function of a guru. You won't forget them. Some people remember their school teachers like that. That's the role. We need a person whom we know knows us and loves us. That is the fundamental. If you know that and trust that person, you will go far. And what's the benefit of that? That's called devotion. And what's devotion? Your heart is wide open and you're able to hear the teachings. It's not intellectual. And so the real practice, I mean, Lama Yeshe's dead, okay? But I talk about him in the present because I work with my practice. We do all these visualization practices and that's our key practice in the Vajrayana. When you do your practices, you visualize oneness with the Lama, you know? The real guru devotion is your practice in your own mind. I mean, I can count on two hands, I think, the personal advice I've had from both of my lamas in the 43 years I've known them. You don't need that. You don't need their physical presence. It's helpful occasionally to be slapped around every now and again. Do you understand? We need a rigsin, a knowledge holder, who has a big heart and whom we can learn, you learn to develop this relationship in your mind. And that's what devotion is. It's got a practical function, you know. It's opening your heart. It's not intellectual. The teachers are incredibly intellectual, but the function of the teacher is to move you and inspire you and really to show you, my gosh, if he can do it, so can I. We need that. We need inspiration, you know. You can't get it from a book. Not possible. We've got a human heart. That's the real function of a guru, you know. So if you're going to have all that relationship, you better choose carefully. Don't give your heart to some wacko, which people do, and then they go sue him later because they didn't check properly. We've got to grow up as well. No one's forcing you to have faith and devotion in a teacher. We're all sentimental and romantic about it. We think they're all gooey and lovely, and then we discover they're jumping on everybody else's girlfriend. Well, be careful who you choose. Be careful. Choose carefully. You're the boss here. Grow up. Be grown up. Then you commit. Then you practice. Does that make sense, people? Do you want to ask me any questions about all that? Because there's a lot of problems with people and gurus. People get very distressed about it. Do you have any questions? Nothing? Yes, sweetheart. Yes, Guillermo. Giuseppe. What?
Sexual abuse allegation recently arisen.
Who? Some lama, you mean?
Yes.
What's the question? What's the question exactly?
What do you think about the risk of undergoing such problems?
I need you to spell it out a bit more and ask a more clear question. I can't quite get your question. Can you sort of spell it out a little bit more? What's the actual question? Sorry.
We recognize when a given behavior is not in accordance with the Dharma.
But that's leaping ahead. Have you decided this person is your guru or not? That's the first question. Have you decided this person is your guru or not?
Yes.
So you mean there's a person...
You're
giving the example of a person who's committed... Wait, you're saying there is a person who's committed to a guru and then they discover, after they've committed, the person is doing what? Doing what? What are they doing, this person? They have done it or you've heard they've done it? Are you certain they've done it or you've heard that they've done it? Is it truth or is it speculation?
An allegation.
Okay, good, an allegation. So then, okay, well, first of all, an allegation, you wait till you've discovered it's the truth, don't you? I mean, the Dalai Lama is accused of doing so many things by the Chinese communists. He'd be imprisoned for 100 years if everything they allege that he does is true. So you've got to first check if it's true. Well, have you found out whether this person has actually abused somebody, or you don't know yet? I'm asking you. Okay. If a person's not your guru and you hear that somebody who's called a guru is abusing people, then you leave them alone, don't you? Right? Would you agree with that? You mind your own business. It's not your business. You mind your own business. You just, you know, we know the world is full of crazy people. I mean, just now I told you this monk in America who has got a center who says he's as a guru, and all these students, and even though he was shown to be a chronic mentally ill liar, people still seem to like him. So you've got to check up. That's why you've got to check up. We have to check up. There are a lot of crazies in the world, you know. Does that make sense to you? Does it answer your question, or is there more question there? But what about this? What about if you have chosen that person as your guru and you are committed to them and you have faith and devotion in them, and then you discover that they're allegedly sexually abusing somebody? So what do you think then would be your right approach? What do you feel? Okay. This is a tricky one, isn't it? Because let's keep it more simple. Let's just keep it like, forget sexual abuse, because that's always such a huge hysterical thing in our culture, isn't it? But let me just say you heard the guru hit somebody. Let's say that. Well, you know, I'll keep it simple as an example like that. So my Mr. Lee, my Kung Fu teacher, I told you, he would scream at me. Now, he's not a Buddha. I'm not saying he's a Buddha. I'm not even saying that. But all I know is, because I trusted him, and I forget Mr. Lee, but Lama Yeshe would shout at me. Lama Zopa would ignore me. So in normal terms, ignoring somebody is bad manners, isn't it? It's kind of rude. But if I've got that relationship with Lama Zopa, and I trust that he wants the best for my mind, and I really do trust that, and that's his expertise. If that is his expertise, and that's what I want from him, like Mr. Lee could see I wanted his kung fu, so he pushed me to my limit. I even hear about football coaches. The players adore their football coach, and he screams and yells and pushes them to the limit. But because they have faith in him and his football, they don't mind being screamed at. So that's all, it's all a question of your relationship. So when Lama Zopa ignored me, or Lama Yeshe would kind of shout at me, if I didn't have confidence in their knowledge and I wasn't sure they really wanted the best from me, I would have felt very nervous. But I had checked. I was confident, and I knew what they were doing was best for my mind. So I didn't mind. Okay, sexual abuse is a we get hysterical when we hear about that one. But I can't go to that one, you know? I mean, there are all sorts of ways they talk in the Vajrayana about the attitude, and it's quite a high attitude. They talk about having pure view, and that's not easy for us. But for example, the sixth Dalai Lama, it's very interesting. The sixth Dalai Lama, it's a very funny, wonderful story about him. You know, the fifth Dalai Lama was really something super famous, and during that time, his, what do they call it, like his administration, all his people were building the Potala, this amazing building in Lhasa. And then he went and died. Well, they didn't want to have to then give up and then get the new reincarnation, because they'd lose their job, and they were worried the Potala wouldn't get built. So they pretended the fifth Dalai Lama was in retreat, and they finished the Potala. I mean, talk about politics. So meanwhile, for several years, the new reincarnation had been born, but he wasn't sort of educated in the right way. And when they finally recognized him, he didn't want to be a monk. He was bored. So he hung out with a prostitute. He wrote love poetry. Now, the interesting point is the Tibetans didn't care, because they have got such confidence that the Dalai Lama is the Buddha. They have confidence that the Dalai Lama is the Buddha. They don't care what he does, because they've got incredible confidence. That's a really good example. He hung out with the prostitute. They just loved him. They didn't mind. They knew he was the Buddha. They knew he was the Buddha. He can do what he likes. But look at us in our culture. We're so cynical. We have so many abusive people in positions of power, more and more and more these days. So many women, for example, not to mention men, are abused. I mean, one of my sisters in Melbourne is a lawyer, who's really supporting all the victims of the Catholic pedophile priests. It's unbelievable, beyond shocking and evil what they've been doing, you know. It's unbelievable. I mean, we can see in the world now so much corruption, so much sexual abuse, because we're in very degenerate times. But that example of the Sixth Dalai Lama is a great one for me. You imagine now if the Dalai Lama disrobed and got a 16-year-old girlfriend. I think 99.9% of the world would give him up. Would be so shocked, even if he's not being illegal. He's allowed to have a girlfriend if he's not a monk. But imagine, even just that would be so shocking to us. Hear it. Imagine the Dalai Lama hanging out with a suit and tie or jeans, you know, with a 16-year-old girlfriend on his arm. 99% of people would give him up and be horrified and depressed. Do you understand my point? That's just being valid. He's allowed to have a girlfriend if he's not a monk. So it's a very touchy one for us, sexual abuse, isn't it? We get very hysterical about it. I mean, it's valid. People abuse, you know. So choose carefully is the point. Choose carefully. And try and develop confidence in their qualities. Do you understand? It's the best I can say, you know. And it's up to us. Not to be sentimental about it, not to follow attachment. That's what we do. We're so attached. And I'll go around all the centres, you know, and all the centres have got many geshis in them. Like here, you've got a couple. There's so much attachment. It's like disgusting among us Westerners. All kind of fanatic, you know. It's fanatic. And when you go to the monasteries, I don't know. I mean, at least then the Tibetans kind of mind their own business about who their teachers are. They don't wear them on their sleeve. We have these big pictures. It's our guru. It's all kind of fanatic emotional and attachment, I think. But it's a very private thing. I never talk about my teachers unless it's in this just class context, you know. It's really private. Are we communicating? Okay. What else, people? Yeah. There's Lama Ursel, Lama Yeshe's reincarnation. He just walked in. Yes.
I was wondering if you recommend the timeline to check on your teacher. Normally, I would think maybe 3 years.
Do you think we should, you mean? You're suggesting?
No,
I know, well, in the teaching, doesn't it say in the teachers we should check for 12?
12 years.
I mean, they say that, I've heard. 12 years. I mean, you'd be dead by then. I don't know. I mean, I hear, you know, you must know. I hear some people. I remember one French student. Many people. As soon as they lay eyes on Lama Zopa, or as soon as they lay eyes on Lama Yeshe, they knew. So we know there are some people like that, and they've never varied in their devotion in 30, 40 years. So it can work for some people. But I suppose, then on the other hand, you have examples of people who check for 10 years and nothing has moved in their heart. They still say, I just can't recognize any guru because there's something blocking, you know. So you can be extreme and be emotional. You can be extreme and be devoted and it can be valid. And then you can check for 22 years and never, your heart doesn't move. So I don't know, you can always, I mean, it's reasonable to check. And as I said before, I did check on Lama, but I didn't know I was checking. I checked on his disciples. Lama Zopa's his disciple. He was a pretty good example. I remember checking on Yeshe Kadro, this nun who ran the center. She was a good example. I really was impressed by the students. I was impressed by his teachings. I was impressed by his behavior. I was impressed by, then I didn't know much. You check with a person's peers as well, don't you? I didn't know any of his peers. But so and I'd done that checking, and that had given me confidence. So I can't give a simple answer to that. I don't know. Depends on the person. But do at least do some checking, not just leap in following attachment, you know. That's the best I can say. You have an opinion? Do you have an opinion? Tell us your opinion.
My opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everybody has an opinion.
Tell us yours.
My opinion?
Mm.
It's very subjective, probably.
I understand. Well, when you had a teacher when you were a little boy, did you check and do those things? Or you just kind of liked him from the beginning, or what? Did it take time, or what?
He was chosen for me.
Oh, okay. But you chose him in your own heart at some point?
Well, I mean, he was the main reason why I stayed
in the monastery.
For so long.
Okay.
Because he was the embodiment of what I was studying.
I understand. So then obviously that's an interesting point because Lama Zopa chose, but at some point you must have agreed with that choice and also from your own heart chosen, isn't it? You did? Okay, okay.
Many times it does happen.
Yes, it's immediate. It was immediate for you, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. You see, that can happen with some people. It's true, isn't it?
You
knew.
Before I met him.
There you go.
Who he was.
Yeah.
He hadn't been chosen yet.
Yes.
But already I had a very strong feeling.
I understand. There you go. That's very fortunate, yeah.
Thank you
so much. Any other questions, folks? Any questions? Yes, Flamel. Yeah, microphone up here.
Persone a volte che mi chiedono se possono avere un guru che ha lasciato il corpo. There were some people that are asking me if they can have a guru that is dead. E come possono fare? E io non è che sappia, quindi chiedo per favore. How can they do?
Well, I mean, I don't know what they say in the teachings. I've heard different things, but all I think is, good Lord above. I know many people who said, I just love Lama Yeshe. I mean, how in the name of heaven can I say don't have them as your guru? If that person moves their heart and they see a photo, how incredibly blessed they are. So please, anyone you like, good Lord, yes, of course, absolutely. I think, no question. Because the function is to move your heart, to open you to yourself, to show you your own qualities, to become a Buddha. That's amazing, whoever moves you. I mean, I remember hearing, I'm a Gelugpa, and my lama's a Gelugpa, but I also have got these connections with other lamas. So as soon as I heard the name of this Nyingma lama called Patrul Rinpoche, he's like 100 years ago, I knew he was one of my guys, you know. Straight away I knew. Then I met one of his disciples, Tsongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche, and I only met him one time. I barged right up and shoved a cutter in his face. I knew he was one of my teachers. I wanted to know, you know. So, and I hardly even knew he was alive, but his Patrul Rinpoche is dead, you know. I knew straight away he was like somebody I recognized, I felt close to. Absolutely, I think nothing wrong with that. More the better.
Then how can we do to have the connection?
Huh? What do you mean, darling? Say it again. What? How can we?
Because in questo caso, che quindi, grazie, ma come può fare una persona ad avere una connessione attraverso una foto, per esempio? How it is possible for the person to have a connection just through a picture?
Through what?
A picture. Just with the picture.
You mean how can it happen or how do you make it happen? I'm sorry, what?
She doesn't understand how actually the person who sees the picture has a connection.
Because they've obviously met before. They have to. It mightn't even have been in the form of Lama Yeshe, but for whatever reason, let's say, that photo of Lama Yeshe triggers obviously a connection with that mind. I mean, you know, it has to be. With me, with Patrul Rinpoche, I didn't even see his picture. I saw his name. I knew it was one of mine. I felt connected. Because obviously met before, that's clear. But that's with ordinary people, too. That's with ordinary people, you know.
Sotto la foto e chiedere per favore puoi diventare il mio guru, sei il mio guru, ti riconosco, ok? Per favore. So she said that this person can go in front of the picture and request the picture, can you be my guru?
No, I mean not any of that. That's a sort of a formal way to do it properly, but if you know, you know, you know, don't worry about that. Just treat them like your guru and open your heart and start practicing. Wow. Be straightforward. I think so. What else, people? Questions? Huh? Any other questions? We can finish early for dinner. It doesn't matter. No questions? No questions? And of course, you can have many teachers. What, darling? John Hunter. What? Good. Go, darling. Yes, good.
Thank you very much. Ci sono delle persone, e io sono qui residente, quindi conosco varie persone. Qualcuno mi ha detto: senti, io ho un guru, no? Però lo vorrei cambiare e prendo un altro. Cioè il guru radice, no? Però siccome ne volevo un altro, lo cambiare, no? Ecco, io dico, ma non lo so mica io, cioè a volte fanno delle domande che io veramente non so.
What you say? Come on. Let me in.
Cambiare così, cioè voglio dire, uno che c'ha un guru, aspetta un momento.
Thank you, let me know. Go on.
Perché c'è un guru che dice, no, che l'ha scelto, è stato attento, è quello. Poi dopo è quello. O si può cambiare con altro? Cioè, come si fa?
Ok, let me know.
Well, some people that ask me, I live here, I'm a resident here, you know, and so you know some people, and they came to me and they said, I have chosen a guru, but now I want to change it.
Okay.
I want a different one.
I understand.
So what can we do in this case?
I understand. To advise them, you mean? You mean to advise these people?
Which kind of advice we can give to these people, yes. It's just like, I have one root guru, but now I don't want to stay with this root guru, I don't want this guru anymore, I want another one.
Okay.
I want a different one.
Well, I mean, we've got, this is why you'd start asking about, I mean, the first thing I would do is start asking them questions. What do you mean, guru? When did you choose? How did they become your guru? You know, have you taken initiations? Have you taken vows? I'd find out the background, and then according to, you know, I mean, that, okay, that happens. Giuseppe's question. Many people have come to me over the years, because I go around the world, different places. People talk in the different traditions, you know, having real struggle, that they've discovered their guru's sexual abuse or has lied or whatever, some done some immoral action, right? And so it's a real trauma for some people. So depending on that person, for example, you know, one nun who's taken highest yoga tantra initiation from a lama who's been accused of abuse, the advice I gave her, this is not quite exactly the answer, but it's part of it. The advice I gave her was completely related to the Vajrayana teachings, and she knew them very well. So it was quite a very strict definition and instruction to her to develop pure view and continue to have pure faith in her teacher for her own benefit. So another person like this, I'd have to ask more opinions. I wouldn't know how to answer until you give me more ideas, you know, more ideas about them. More information about what the story is. So if you tell me, if they suddenly tell you they've taken highest yoga tantra initiation, they've got bodhisattva vows, tantric vows, they've taken refuge, then I'll have a very serious discussion with them. What do you mean by this? So I'll tell you my own example of misconduct of a guru. When I was the first centre I worked at for Lama Yeshe was Manjushri Institute in England. I don't know if you've heard of it, but now the Lama there, Geshe Kalsan Gyatso, who is a fellow disciple of Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe's root guru, they've all got the same root guru, and Lama Yeshe appointed him to be there as the resident teacher. So eventually, this, to cut a story short, this Lama, there's a schism, a huge schism there, and this Lama took the centre, and then went against Lama Yeshe. Other things have happened since then. But basically, there's a Lama. So I had taken initiation from this Lama. I had taken an initiation, which means I'd seen him as a guru. I'd taken tantric vows, bodhisattva vows, and all the others. So he was one of my teachers. He was one of my gurus. And he's, you know, and I would practice, like with all my gurus, seeing them as a manifestation of Buddha mind. That's the practice when you really get, you know, basic practice, which is what they call pure view, which is not comfortable and not easy if we've not heard the teachings. So for me, that was kind of the logic of that was very clear. So then this happens, and he goes against Lama Yeshe, takes Lama Yeshe Center. I mean, that's a really classic example, quite a difficult decision. So I tried to apply then the teachings that are given, which for me were I find these quite logical. And it's this. So first of all, it wasn't a happy experience. The mind is unhappy. This Lama's taken Lama Yeshe Center, and then there's a big schism among all the students. It's very distressing, you know. So but because I had taken initiation, because I had committed to him as to be one of my teachers, I had chosen that. No one forced me. Then I knew, this is the whole point now. This is the point now, if we can get this. I haven't seen him in 30 years. I haven't seen him in 30, I've not been back. But in my mind, I decided, and this is for my benefit, I decided, fundamentally, what are you trying to do as a Buddhist? You're trying to have less attachment, less anger, less jealousy, less neurosis, less misery, and more happiness, more wisdom, and more clarity. Is that right, people? Fundamental, isn't it? So then I had to, what was the choice I had? To find fault in this person, to be angry, to be upset, or to decide, I'm not clairvoyant, I cannot possibly say what his reasoning was for doing this, but when you hear in the Bodhisattva teachings, especially, forget the tantric, you hear all the description, we're going to talk tomorrow morning a bit about the Bodhisattva path, it's pretty outrageous. By the time you get to even low-level Bodhisattva, you're a pretty special person. You've gone beyond delusions to a radical degree. You might even not have realized emptiness yet. Maybe you realize emptiness and already you can manifest your mind in many bodies. You're a pretty outrageous person. And the Bodhisattvas, fundamentally, because they've gone beyond delusions to a fairly radical degree, and because they have such fierce compassion for sentient beings, they even have a Bodhisattva vow that says it is right to harm a sentient being, to break another vow, if it's for that sentient being's sake. Now, this is not comfortable in our culture. We have a panic attack about that. But only when you understand the Bodhisattva teachings can you see the logic of that. In other words, we have to deduce the possibility that there can be a person who has literally gone beyond delusions, gone beyond neurosis, has realized emptiness, is a powerful Bodhisattva, forget Buddha, and has enormous compassion. So because of that, they've got this long-term view, the long-term view, and they can see exactly what they're doing. If you can posit the possibility of a person like that, then it's completely logical that Geshe Kelsang Gyatso could be a Buddha, could be a Bodhisattva. I'm not clairvoyant. I cannot tell. So why not protect my mind from being deluded and leave it there, back away, keep my mind pure, thank him for his teachings, and think he's the manifestation of the Buddha for the sake of sentient beings. Which is better for our mind? That is better. The world doesn't approve of that because we want to be political, we want to leap in and point fingers, you know, but the main point of this is to protect my mind. I'm not clairvoyant. I cannot say that Geshe Kelsang Gyatso is not the Buddha. Just like the sixth Dalai Lama, the Tibetans don't care what he did. They knew he was the Buddha. They had confidence. This is kind of powerful teaching. This is not comfortable for our minds because we believe what we see. That man's evil. He must be evil. So I want to protect my mind. So I left it there and I have never criticized him and I have never criticized his students. And it was a very painful time. That for me is the essence of the answer. But that takes courage because we want to find fault. We want to be angry. We want to be upset. So if they're ready, I'd give that advice. Depends on the person. But if that person has heard about this guru, you know, or they're not that person's disciple, and that guru wants to have sex with him, I'd tell him to go punch him in the bloody nose and kick him in the balls. That's what I'd tell him. Thank you. Depends on your relationship. Tell the fella to fuck off. I hope Italians don't know what that means. I mean, that's what I would say to somebody. These ridiculous men and their dicks, you know. God damn it. Oh, don't get me started. Excuse me. I mean, we're all women. I mean, my father abused me. I've been raped by a couple of Puerto Ricans in New York, in Italy, actually. It wasn't Italians who raped me. It was someone else. So you guys got away with it. Every country I've been, men want to jump on you, you know? So you've got to be a bit brave, women, and jump on them back. When I was a radical lesbian separatist feminist, my policy when I lived in London, I didn't sit there like a little mouse and complain and try and sue them. I had a policy that a man said anything to me in the street and then you were allowed to. It wasn't politically incorrect. And I had a nice chest. I was quite pretty looking with long hair. Any man who said anything to me, I'd walk up to him, I'd scream at him in public, I'd kick him in the balls and I'd insult him. And I thought that's just perfectly reasonable behaviour. And every single man I did it to was mortified, except for one guy, a Greek guy in London, who traced me down the street and hit me back. And I was very honoured. I said, well done. I was quite impressed by his courage, you know. Do you understand? I took the power into my own hands. So then you can have some courage. Tell these fellows to bugger off, you know. Well, he's ridiculous. But he's your guru, somehow the discussion, all right? Don't punch your guru in the nose. Are we communicating here, people? All right. Maybe it's time for dinner. All right. Thank you. So we think all these moments that we've been here, as many moments as we've had, as many seeds we've planted in our minds, how marvellous. May all these teachings have some kind of grow deep in our minds so we can get amazing understanding of the way things are, so we can stop our misery and suffering, so we can stop harming others, so we can be of benefit to others. That's our potential. Just, in other words, to do what our lamas do. So we just think, may we never develop, even for a moment, wrong views towards the deeds of our most precious gurus, with faith and respect gained from seeing their goodness. May their full inspiration flow into our hearts. Changchub Semchog Rinpoche, Makye Panam Keguchi, Kye Panyampa, Mepayang Gong Ne Gondu Pelba Shogam. May think of dinner. We've been talking about it, so think of dinner differently, okay? Don't believe what you see. Dinner's coming from your mind, not from the dinner. There's this stuff there, so think of it as having no inherent nature. See it as bliss, nectar. And then you think of all the beings in the universe, all the gurus and buddhas and beings experiencing the joy of receiving it. Imagine that. Lama Sangye, Lama Chö, Dejen Lama Gerunte, Kungi Jepo Lama Te, Lama Namla, Chöpa Bull. Okay, people, that'll do. See you at 8:30, right? Is that the plan? No, not today. I'm completely confused. What's happening? We're done. What's happening tonight? Oh, it's party. Oh, it's our party tonight. Oh, okay. So the gala dinner. Gala is at what time? 8 o'clock. Okay. All right. Whatever. I'll see you tomorrow morning. All being well. Do your homework. And if you wake up in the morning, bliss out that you're not dead yet, okay? And make the most of the last moment we have together in the morning. Thank you, people.